This is Serendipity.
Yeah, you're listening to Serendipity.
Think anyone will find this?
Somebody's gonna find it.
It's where robots fall in love.
I want to peel you like a carrot.
And flamingos can sound like Tom Waits.
Hey, girly, do you know what the collective noun is for a group of flamingos?
Join me, Anne Hepperman.
And me, Martin Johnson.
For Serendipity, where we play the best audio fiction from around the world. Because this revolution will not be televised. Find Serendipity wherever you get your podcasts.
From KCRW, this is Here Be Monsters.
It was a hot day for me, probably nothing unusual by Mississippi standards. But my body, still acclimatized to the Pacific Northwest, was sweating and had a tendency to burn. I was 28 days from home, standing at a literal crossroad in the Mississippi Delta. The road that branched off to the northwest would carry me the 75 miles to my day's goal of Forest City, Arkansas. It was an interstate town where the cars would be more amenable to my cardboard signs. Country roads, like this one, were hard to hitchhike on. I was at this intersection looking for a critical truth that I needed. I was a 22-year-old kid with a trimmed beard, straight teeth, and a life that, by nearly every metric, was an easy one. And as such, I'd obtained a certain comfort in my home life, and a certain Bilbo Baggins-esque trepidation of the outside world. So, that summer, I left home. I told my friends that I was off for the summer to collect photographs and stories, but really that was just a guise. What I really wanted to know was I wanted to know what strangers would do if they saw me standing by the side of the road with a cardboard sign and my thumb out. I wanted to know if they would chop me up and put me in their trunks. And so far, between the trucker, the classical violinist, the nice lady driving the Jaguar, the preacher, the anarchist, the self-described Hicks, and all the others who had driven me this far, not one had tried to chop me, not even a little bit. Some had even fed me, and I found it all exhilarating. But the day before this day, I'd been eating at a restaurant in Mississippi late at night, and outside these two guys started fighting, and they had guns. After six or seven pops, one of them was dead, and the other one went to the hospital. It was my first hitchhiking experience that made me feel truly, deeply unsafe, and it rattled every corner of me. I made the decision then to turn around. I wasn't sure if it was exactly the right decision or exactly the wrong one. But even before the shooting, I'd already felt something shifting in my brain. This was just a tangible event to glue it to. The thrill of hitchhiking was beginning to wear thin on me as I felt a storm of quiet homesickness roiling in the edge of my thoughts. I told no one about this homesickness. I couldn't afford to expose myself as the travel-weary kid I was. Instead, I wanted people to see the cheerful vagabond I imitated. But yeah, the homesickness. I could feel it there, thickening and forming into clouds in my mind, and I worried about what might happen when that storm struck in earnest while I was still far from home, still far from the people who loved me and worried about me. Of course, there were real storms, too. These had chased me eastward from Washington, through Idaho, across the Rockies, and over the Great Plains and into the south. And now, here at my turning around point, the storm clouds would instead lie in front of me each day. They'd churn all afternoon in the western skies, and then clash with me come nightfall. But the sky was clear today, for now. So I pulled out my cardboard sign, made from an empty box I'd found in a dumpster, and I wrote a single word on it with my best black Sharpie, Arkansas. I held it up and smiled and waited. My mental powers felt strong just then, so I switched on the invisible laser beam that sometimes emanates from between my eyes and an inch above them. The beam shot directly out of my forehead and onto the front bumper of the only car I could see. I knew it worked because the car approached me and slowed down and pulled off to the shoulder of the road and stopped and rolled down the passenger window. And that's how I started my journey home, how I got my ride to the casino, and how I met Trick, the second baddest motherfucker I'd meet that day.
Here Be Monsters, the podcast about
thunderclaps and dreams of mosquitoes.
The podcast about
the unknown.
Okay, more about that mental laser. In the first grade, my grandma took me to see the movie Matilda. And I realized on that day that, like Matilda, I had the subtle power of telekinesis. I trained myself to hone my mind into a point, lift the edges of magazines without touching them. I learned to slightly flex the passage of time, and I learned how to move my whole body with a grace only possible through levitation. And for several years, I practiced with my mental laser daily, pleased with its growing strength. But it was a power that could not be used too often because it easily exhausted with overuse, so I used it sparingly. But even as an adult, I would still occasionally turn it back on, especially on hot hitchhiking days in the South. I struggled to understand Trick through the passenger window of his immaculate car. He spoke so softly and with a southern accent thick enough to lack pauses between words and sentences. He pointed up the road north and west, offering me a quiet stream of words from which I understood little. But he smiled at me, wearing his mechanic shirt with a breast patch bearing his name, T-R-I-C. So I got in, and I sat my giant blue backpack on top of my lap. And I noticed the massive speakers behind me that filled the entire backseat. We spoke very little as we sped off down the road. Instead, we watched the watermelon fields and the outcroppings of ivy-choked trees blast past us at highway speeds. And to spare ourselves from silence, Trick showed me what those speakers were for. Fast rolls of hi-hats flew out our open windows and over the landscape of the Mississippi Delta. It was loud, but I didn't cover my ears. That's just not proper etiquette. As we arrived at the casino, Trick pulled off the highway and the car stopped, and to my surprise he leaned over to me. He cupped his hands around his mouth to amplify himself, and he leaned up close and told me something. He separated each word as much as possible for the sake of my understanding. And he spoke it with the stoicism of a blessing. It was just a single sentence, one that I wasn't sure was true. I'd have to mull it over for a while. Trick smiled at me again, then pulled away towards the casino parking lot, and the sound of blasting hi-hats faded slowly with him. Day was already cloudier. I could see the afternoon's cumulus forming at the horizon, but I'd barely even held up my sign when a white SUV came to an abrupt stop near me. At the window, a 60-something grandmother named Sue smiled down at me, looking like she'd won $1 million. She had white hair and a lead foot. This didn't surprise me in the slightest. The most telltale sign of someone who would stop for me wasn't their age, income, race, gender, or political affiliation. It was just the speed they drove at. Fast. Always fast. But Sue told me she'd behave for me, since it was rude to speed with company in the car. I thanked her for that, and we drove at 75 miles per hour over a giant metal bridge and into Arkansas. She dropped me in a small town. I grabbed my bag, said goodbye, and shut the door. I'd scarcely turned around before Sue was out of sight, no longer behaving for her company. I stood at the edge of town and held my sign. Cars passed me with suspicious eyes. It was late afternoon now, and I looked north, down the road that would take me a number of miles to my goal of Forest City. And I looked west. The clouds on the horizon had bunched up around the edges, turning into tall pillars, seeming closer and heavier with each moment. The past 28 days of travel taught me how to judge the weight of a cumulus, how to tell if it looked like it was about to fall from the sky from holding too much rain. It was clear to me that these clouds and I were racing to the same place, and I hoped desperately that I would win. I smiled at the cop who drove past me. He made a slow-motion U-turn and flipped on the lights. He asked for my identification and ran me for warrants. It's illegal to hitchhike in Arkansas. The officer looked about 10 years older than me, with his crew cut and his brown hair, and a face scrunched into a perpetual look of concern. His uniform had a pin with his name on it. It read, Officer Honeycomb. Officer Honeycomb said, he said, you're a long ways from home, son. And I said, yes, I'm trying to get back there. It's illegal to hitchhike in Arkansas. I'm sorry, sir. Officer Honeycomb could have, should have, written me a ticket right then and there, but for whatever reason, he was feeling generous that day. He handed back my ID, and he told me he'd do me a favor. He opened up the back door of his police cruiser and gestured for me to toss in my bag. I did, and I asked him if I should sit in the front or the back. As we drove off, Officer Honeycomb looked at me from his rearview mirror, made occasional eye contact through the plexiglass. He told me that he'd drop me at the city line, and from there, I could walk to Forest City, and I could catch a bus going west. At the city line, he pulled over and let me out of the back seat. The sun was gone now, hidden behind the approaching storm clouds. I pulled on my backpack, and we stood there, in the dusk, and talked for a moment. Officer Honeycomb said, he said, Jeff, let me give you some valuable information. Forest City is a prison city, and you don't want to wind up anywhere near that prison looking like that. He approximately gestured at me. So when that road up there forks, just remember, don't go left. I thanked him for this warning. And another thing, you see that forest out there? Officer Honeycomb gestured off the highway into the scrubby trees. You're going to have to sleep out there tonight. And when you do, you're going to need to keep an ear out for razorbacks. They're nocturnal. They come out at night to sharpen their tusks on the tree trunks. And if they catch smell of you, that's real bad news. So if you hear them, you'd best run or climb something before they get you with those tusks. Unsure of what to say or believe, I just stood there. Officer Honeycomb noticed this and rubbed his palms together loudly. He said, "They're tusks, grinding up on those trees. It sounds like this. Son, you keep an ear out for that sound." We headed in opposite directions, Honeycomb back towards town, and me walking down the wide shoulder of the highway towards Forest City. I didn't dare put my thumb out, lest Honeycomb sneak up behind me and write me that ticket that I deserved. I walked as quickly as I could, lifting my feet off the ground. I willed them to be energetic and light, but my body was tired and my power of levitation was weak. Eventually, I came to a small green highway sign. Forest City, it said. 14 miles. I didn't know what to do, so I just kept walking with my thumbs in my pockets. I looked out into the scrubby trees being slowly choked to death by ivy. I listened for the sounds of rubbing palms. I watched for the wild pigs. And I moved slowly closer to Forest City, but I was losing my race with the black clouds. It was just minutes before the rain came when John Paul spotted me walking down the highway. He pulled his big white truck over onto the shoulder and flipped it into reverse. I ran to meet him in the middle, but when I looked inside the truck, both rows were already full. 7 grown men sat in those seats, glistening from a full day's work in the sun. There was no way I'd fit. John Paul saw my sad face and threw a huge grin at me. He gestured back to the pickup bed and told me to get in. I pushed tarp-covered machines aside and made a space to crawl into, and we took off down the highway. Instantly, the first dry lightning bolt fell into the field to my right, and then another, and another crack, and another, and we were all in the midst of it. And then the rain came, and at the first drops, John Paul pulled the truck over again, beckoning for me to come up into the cab, telling me that they'd make room. There were then 8 of us in that truck cab. Only John Paul spoke English well. He explained to me that they were irrigation workers from Texas doing a contract up here in Arkansas. The rain came down harder now, and we took a Y in the road. John Paul asked me where I was from, and I told him I was from Washington State. He'd never been. He asked me what it was like there, and I told him how beautiful it was, and how nice the people could be. I told him that the trees looked really different, and instead of ivy, there was moss. I told him that it rained all winter, and that early in those mornings, you might sometimes catch fog clinging to the streetlights. John Paul asked me if I missed home, and I shrugged off his question with the facade of indifference. John Paul reminded me of how the balance had now tipped. On one side of the scale, there was the sense of an eager adventure I'd felt so many days ago when I left home. And on the other side of that scale were the pangs of homesickness that were now growing and metastasizing through my mind. We arrived in Forest City. He let me out in a motel parking lot. I was feeling low, but I thanked John Paul for saving me from sleeping in the trees, and I told him goodbye. The rain was coming down hard now with the lightning. In the dark city ahead of me, Interstate 40 glowed bright orange, and so I walked towards it like a moth. I found myself in the bright foyer of Walmart. I sat on a bench across from a line of electric wheelchairs, fully charged. I went into the store and bought myself a small loaf of sweet cake, marbled, chocolate, and vanilla. I promised myself I wouldn't eat it until morning, when it would be a gift to myself, a way to celebrate the storm's passing. I returned to the foyer, sat on the bench again, charged my phone, and felt sorry for myself. Yes, I was homesick, and yes, it was a homesickness I brought upon myself by leaving that home, just to prove a point, just to answer a question about the goodwill of strangers. I was still 2 time zones from most everyone I cared about and most everyone who cared about me. I thought again of the words that Trick offered me outside the casino at our parting. And again, I doubted them. I could still hear the storm pounding outside and in my head, but I didn't cry, though. I just fortified my facade of indifference, and I snuck a bite from that cake. I looked at those wheelchairs again, and for a moment I considered stealing one, riding off into the storm, past the parking lot, onto the street, out into the town, just to see how far I could get before the battery died or before someone called the police. Had fate twisted slightly different that night, I might have done it. But instead, I got a high five from a kid. It was a young couple who left the store with their 8-year-old trailing far behind. He walked with an impossibly light step, nearly floating across the tile floor. Maybe he had also seen Matilda. And just as he was about to hover past me, he stopped for a second, looked me up and down. I think he saw what I was feeling. I think he saw the self-pitying, homesick, soon-to-be-very-wet person that I was. So he reached up his hand to me and held it for the high five. Then he ran off into the night to rejoin his parents. I slept near Interstate 40 that night. It was behind a plumbing store, where I found a covered concrete loading dock several feet above the ground. It was as dry a spot as I could have hoped for. I laid out on top of my sleeping bag, soaking wet. It seemed too loud and too hot to rest. But eventually, I passed into a light sleep that was punctuated by thunderclaps and dreams of mosquitoes. It was still ungodly hot out when I woke up. The rain was gone and the sky was clear. It was damp and I was in a bad mood, but I was still alive. I immediately ate the rest of my consolation cake. I imagined how my life might be a little bit different right now had I taken that ride in the wheelchair. I wondered again who would have found me and where I'd be. And those questions were immediately answered for me the moment I walked out onto the on-ramp of Interstate 40. And received a stark reminder that Forest City was a prison city. In the distance, I could see a dozen orange jumpsuits tending to the trash on the road and trimming the grass of the giant overpass. I held out my cardboard sign and forced smiles at the passing cars. My goal for the day was Little Rock, a straight shot, 90 miles west, and it should have been easy to get that kind of ride, but no one stopped. I stood there for an hour, attempting to jumpstart my mental laser. But it was still depleted. I was still depleted. The orange jumpsuits worked slowly towards me, and I could eventually tell that there were people inside of them. And I could just barely see a single prison guard standing underneath the overpass by a giant pickup truck. He leaned against it. Eventually, one of the prisoners spotted me, and he called over 4 or 5 of his friends. The group came towards me, and for just an instant, I was as afraid as I was the first time I ever stuck my thumb out. All things told, my luck with strangers had been pretty good this far, but maybe it had been too good. The first guy walked up to me and stood much closer than I would have liked. He spoke roughly and seemed mean. But he just wanted to talk weather. He told me there was going to be another hot day. He asked me how much water I had. I showed him that I had half a bottle. He said it wasn't enough. So the whole group of us walked to the underpass and he showed me a giant water cooler and I refilled my water bottle and thanked him. The guard pretended not to notice us at all. I walked back to the on-ramp with a full water bottle. Not even a day earlier, Trick had picked me up from the crossroads. On one road was the option to continue exploring America, to continue meeting strangers, to continue trying my luck, and on the other road was the chance to return home, a place I was lucky to have, a place that came with a dry bed and a lack of uncertainty. When I made the choice to take the road home, I wasn't sure if it was the right one. I was worried that I was again succumbing to my own fear, and that saddened me. But the answer felt clear now. It was time for me to go back to Washington. I was still 3,000 miles from there, but so much less afraid of strangers. So I found a new piece of cardboard, and I made a new sign, and I wrote it with my best black Sharpie. I wrote the word West. I held it up and smiled. The last words of Trick were still replaying in my mind. He spoke with a self-assuredness that I could never recreate for you if I spent my whole life trying. Trick said to me, he said, Jeff, you're one badass motherfucker. And in that moment, all I could think to say back to him was, thanks, Trick. You too. In the coming weeks, I'd meet crust punks, church singers, train hoppers, IT professionals, and not one of them tried to chop me up and put me in their trunks. Not one. Some even fed me. Including Alan, a kind-hearted man driving a minivan. I pulled him off the road with a particularly lucky beam from between my eyes. He drove me fast down Interstate 40 for a number of miles, and then let me off at a truck stop where he handed me a paper basket full of potato JoJo's. As we said goodbye, I asked Alan whether wild hogs ever sharpened their tusks on tree bark and trampled people to death. And he laughed and laughed and laughed at the hitchhiker who was afraid of wild hogs. And then he drove off. I sat for a while at that Arkansas truck stop and looked at the sky. It was clear now, but I could see some heavy cumulus boiling near the horizon again. There was going to be another storm tonight, but it was okay, because this motherfucker was headed home. This episode was produced by me, Jeff Empman. I had editing help from David Weinberg, Nick White, Bethany Denton, and Rebecca Brune. The story I told in this episode comes from a larger series that I produced back in the very early days of Here Be Monsters. You can find out more about the trip that I took back in episodes 17 and 18 as part of a two-part series I made called How I Learned to Love Rejection. You can find those by scrolling deep into your podcast app or by going to our website, hbmpodcast.com, where we have those two episodes linked up in the description of this episode. Also on our website, we have a map showing all the places I visited in this episode, along with little bits of additional anecdote. I also put together a photo gallery with pictures from the trip, including a bunch of beautiful storm pictures from all across America, and a shot of that Forest City 14-mile sign, and a shot of John Paul and his six coworkers. He's smiling at me. Again, we're at hbmpodcast.com. Music on this episode from The Black Spot, Sarocell, and Ahi. That's A-H-E-E. Ahi's a musician that I found way back in the early days of the show, and I tried to get a hold of him via Facebook. But you know how Facebook sends those messages between strangers into that folder called Other that no one ever looks at ever? Ahi actually found my message this last summer, and he finally wrote back. And I think it's really neat music. You're hearing it right now. As always, you can find links to our musicians on our website. This episode marks the beginning of our fifth season of shows, and that means that we're bringing you 20 more unusual, beautiful, and troubling stories over the next 9 or so months. Some of the episodes that we're working on right now are about sexual synesthesia, brain tumors, and flesh-eating beetles. Keep an eye out on your podcast feed every other Wednesday, and please tell your friends and enemies about the show. It's the number one way that we grow. Here Be Monsters is proud to be a part of the independent producer project from KCRW. Thanks for listening. More episodes soon.